Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Clubs and Forum. Tonight our guest is Daily Kos blogger Marcos Melitzas. Mr. Melitzas served in the U.S. Army for 3 years and later earned two bachelor degrees from Northern Illinois University and a law degree from Boston University. After moving to California to work in the tech industry, he started DailyKos.com in 2002. That is now one of the top political websites, indeed overall websites, in the country, and he's a celebrity among bloggers and the Netroots political activists.
We're nerds.
Celebrity nerd.
Exactly.
While he actively supports Democratic candidates, he has plenty of harsh words for the Democratic Party establishment. So please welcome Marcos Melitzas. Welcome, and thanks for coming to the Commonwealth Club. Could you lay out for us sort of the general structure of your critique with the Democratic establishment and what you think's wrong with it?
Yeah, absolutely. They lose. I mean, at the end of the day, that's the bottom line. In politics, only one thing matters, and that's whether you can win or you can lose. And we have a party establishment that has done really nothing but lose, and there has been no self-reflection. There has been no attempt to clean out its ranks, no attempt to change its strategies and its tactics to accommodate a changing political and media landscape. And ultimately, what we have is a closed-in bubble in D.C., and these people have their turf, they have their consultancies, they have their little power bases, and it doesn't matter to them that the nation is going where it's at, because in their little world, they're doing pretty well. They got their nice little parking spots, they hang out at the cocktail party circuits, you know, you have people kissing rings, because even in defeat, even in the minority, they have a certain amount of power. And really, there's a complete disconnect to what's happening in the rest of the country. There is a complete, almost obliviousness. I mean, this is a quick example just to show what it's like in D.C. I was on CNN Reliable Sources a couple of weeks ago, and in the green room with me were Bill Press, who's a liberal radio guy, commentator, and Bill Bennett, who's the bloviating blowhard. and they say Michael Moore is fat. And in the green room, they were basically, how's the kid? How's the wife? Oh, it's great, great, great. Hey, we haven't done lunch in a while. Let's do lunch. How's Thursday look? I don't know about Thursday. Wednesday? Well, maybe I can do Wednesday. No, okay, Thursday looks fine. Let's do Thursday. They go on camera, and they're screaming at each other because they hate each other. You're wrong. You're an idiot. Camera turns off. They shake hands. See you Wednesday. Great seeing you again. Let's all hang out. For them, it's a game. This is what D.C. has become. It's a game for every single one of them. They don't really care that their policies and their way they do business have real-world repercussions with millions of Americans across the country. So what we're saying is that we're done with that system. We're tired of it. We need to crash those gates, and we need to get some reality into what is extremely, it's kind of Alice in Wonderland world that is Washington, D.C.
You mentioned that there's not a lot of self-reflection or change, but some people would say that having Howard Dean as the chair of the DNC was not business as usual for the Democrats, or do you think it is business as usual?
Well, Howard Dean was elected DNC chairman not because of Washington, D.C. It was a coalition of bloggers, grassroots activists, and state party people. I mean, this is not a blogger, you know, rule the world kind of, you know, I'm not that kind of person. But there was a lot of real-world politicking by state party chairs that helped Howard Dean get elected to the chairmanship. Nice little factoid is that Howard Dean has never spent a night in Washington, maybe not has never, but does not, as a course of business, spend any nights in Washington, D.C. He will not sleep in Washington, D.C., which is probably a good thing because he would be poisoned in his sleep. Not by Republicans or Democrats, but by both working together. It'd be this coalition black ops unit. And so the knives are out for Howard Dean in D.C., which is good that he avoids the place, because at the end of the day, the DNC is a bureaucracy. It's not a massive bureaucracy, but really at the end of the day, the party committees are run by consultants all the nuts and bolts positions in the party committees are run by consultants. That's why D.C. is such a close society, because the people who get the contracts are going to be running the party the next cycle. And so the people who are running the party now want to make sure that the next guys give them the nice, cushy consulting gigs. So it's this kind of revolving chair system. And until that's busted, it's tough. So Howard Dean is doing what he can, but there's a whole culture, there's a whole bureaucracy, and it's great that we have him at the top. It's better than if we didn't have him at the top. But ultimately, it's just part of the process. One of the things that we advocate is realizing that we have to take over our state parties, local parties, and also we've got the top, but we also got to start working the bottom and kind of work our way up. And so, you know, if we hit by both sides, eventually we can hopefully clean out the place.
And who's we?
We is a very amorphous, leaderless, people-powered movement that in a lot of ways was inspired by Howard Dean, was inspired by to become, even by John Kerry, people who were inspired to become active in politics who were not traditionally involved in politics. And once the election was over, traditionally people would kind of just head home and not think about politics for another 3 years. Things are changing. I think people are realizing that the country is in serious need of change, and people aren't really that willing to just go home anymore. They're getting involved. They're taking over to local parties. They're starting... people with money are putting money into venture funds to build the institutions of the vast left-wing conspiracy. Yeah, you laugh, but we ain't got nothing. And it's even a lot of the reform labor unions, you know, the SEIUs that broke off in the traditional labor movement, realizing that the traditional labor movement was failing. Its numbers are going down. And the millions and millions of dollars it was investing in politics were basically being squandered, that the best way the unions can help Democrats win is to make more union members, and that's the opposite of what was happening. So this is a very broad movement. I mean, people, the media and pundits and critics want to minimize it and say it's a bunch of bloggers, it's a bunch of left-wing radical wackos, they want to purge the party. And, yeah, well, actually, we kind of do want to purge the party. That part's right. But not in the way that they think. This is not an ideological movement. It's a very practical one. It's one that's looking for Democrats that can win, as opposed to people who continue to basically do work that's losing us elections. And there's no repercussions. There's no transparency. There's no accountability. That's what we demand.
It's interesting that you're sort of posing this insurgency within the structure of the system rather than advocating for another party or a third party. Why is that?
Everybody, a lot of people have romantic notions of what a third party, of a rise of a third party, you know, because everybody's idea of a third party is they're perfect. Everything, you know, somebody that agrees with them 100%. Man, if we only had a third party, they'd agree with me on everything. But it'd be a very small third party, right? It'd be a third party one. And this notion that we can find a third party where everybody could agree with, all the discontented people could agree with, it's actually quite fiction. We saw this with the Reform Party, right, where it broke down into the Buchanan faction versus the Perot faction versus the Jesse Ventura faction. And by the time they were all done suing each other and fighting over the party, there was nothing left. I mean, it was a hollow shell, a nothing of a party. So to me, the third party is a fiction. Now, what I could see happening is the rise of somebody who might transcend politics, somebody who would be apolitical in a lot of ways. That is theoretically possible. I think technology, the web, makes that kind of candidacy within the realm of possibility. I'm not saying probability, but within the realm of possibility. Third parties, though, are doomed. And I like to learn lessons from the conservative movement. In 1964, they were absolutely beaten. They were crushed. Barry Goldwater was absolutely trounced in an election. And the Republican Party establishment at the time reestablished control of the party apparatus. Now, this is a Republican Party. Keep in mind that with Richard Nixon created the Environmental Protection Agency and OSHA. And it was a very different kind of Republican Party at the time. And the conservative movement, the conservatives hated them. It was vicious, vicious battles. And so at the time, there was a big debate within that conservative movement between the Goldwaterites whether they should start a third party. And they realized and decided correctly, obviously, that it did not make sense to further split the right, and it made a lot more sense to take over the existing party of the right. A party, at the end of the day, is basically a shell. It does not have a position, does not have an ideology. It reflects the ideology of those who run it. So it was a lot easier for them to take over that conservative Republican Party and make it their own than it would have been had they tried to start a third party. Now, in 1976, Ronald Reagan was their vehicle. That's what they pushed, and they lost the primary. They lost the primary against Gerald Ford. 1980, things turned around. So it took him 16 years to win the win the White House, and it took him 30 years to take over Congress fully with the Gingrich Revolution. Very efficient. So I'm thinking when they started building this in 64, they didn't have the think tanks. They did not have the leadership institutes, the training institutes, the media machine. They didn't have the effective consultants, the party machinery. They built all of that from scratch. It took them 30 years to do that. I think we can build ours in a lot shorter because of technology, because of how quickly things advance. To me, a perfect example of that is it's conservatives have three brick-and-mortar institutions that look for media bias. And when they have these academics doing these long reports, and they issue these 30-page white papers of media bias, liberal media. Look at them, they're everywhere. And then they deliver these reports to their media machine, Fox News and Rush Limbaugh and 700 Club and Wall Street Journal editorial board and so on and so on. And that was very effective back in the 80s, 90s, and even earlier this decade, because it's a movement built for the last century. We have Media Matters, one organization, and their pushback, their response to conservative bias in the media is instantaneous. Within an hour of Rush Limbaugh's show, they have a whole report showing how Rush lied about X number of issues. So it's much more effective. We only need one. They have three. We need one. So we don't have to match them institution by institution. We don't even have to match them on size and scope. I'm sure Media Matters' budget is much smaller than those three conservative institutions looking for media bias. But we can do so more effectively, more efficiently, and get the information out much quicker than they do. So we're building a movement for the 21st century while they're still kind of saddled in a lot of ways with the movement built for the 20th century.
Not long ago, liberals loathed the Central Intelligence Agency as the enemy of democratic governments, and they installed dictators around the world. And these days, you read the papers, and people on the left are rallying to the defense of the CIA and indignant when the CIA is politicized. How did this come about that suddenly liberals are championing the CIA?
I don't know. Do
you find it strange or ironic that all this sudden love for the CIA?
I think a lot of the people that did have problems with the CIA, it was a very vocal minority. I think most people didn't really think about it that much, right? It wasn't really under radar screens in the way that now it is, because now we're in this huge war, and it was the CIA that was warning the administration against invading because there were no weapons of mass destruction. Here's a little secret I don't think I've ever written about. But in 2001, I was underemployed. I was in that, y'all have been there, right, .com people? Kind of like between jobs, and you do a little contract work and kind of, so that's where I was in this really horrible netherworld of will I make rent next month. And so I applied to the CIA. And I went all the way to the end. It was to the point where I was going to sign papers to become clandestine services. And it was at that point that the Howard Dean campaign took off. And I had to make a decision whether I was going to kind of join the Dean campaign, that whole process, or was I was going to become a spy. And it was going to be a tough decision at first. But then the CIA insisted that if I joined that, they'd want me to do the first duty assignment in Washington, D.C., and I hate Washington, D.C. And it was 6 years in Washington, D.C. before they'd post me overseas, and I was like, yeah, that made the decision a lot easier. But what was really amazing about that experience is that every single person I talked to in the CIA, and I must have talked to dozens of people, psychologists and people in the leadership, and you go through this whole, 6-month process, really in depth, every single one of them was liberal. Every single one of them. And to the point where I was talking to somebody, we were talking about my website, because I knew about my website, and she was agreeing with me on everything, this is before the war, right? And she kept saying, man, they're going to take us to war, and, it's just, the evidence isn't there, and this is crazy. And I was like, so is this just you or what? And she's like, no, we're all like this here. This is a very liberal institution. And in a lot of ways, it does attract people who want to make a better, you know, want to make the world a better place. I mean, people who are internationalist in general really aren't people who say, I want to go bomb the fuck out of some other country, right? That's not, do you have to bleep that out on the radio?
Yeah, let's just try to say it again.
I'll let you bleep it out. And so it's, I mean, and when you think of it in a more logical sense, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. Of course, they got their dirty ops and this and that, right? But as an institution itself, the CIA is actually really interested in the stable world. That's what they're interested in. And stable worlds aren't created by destabilizing regimes and by starting wars. They're done so by other methods, you know, assassinating labor leaders. And no, I'm kidding. But that was really surprising to me. So coming from that, and of course, I think a lot of conservatives would kind of take that as, you know, evidence that the CIA was out to undermine Bush or something because they are a bunch of liberals, and they were a bunch of liberals. But ultimately, that was an eye-opening experience for me, and because ultimately, I don't think it's a very partisan thing to want a calm, stable world, and even if you're protecting American interests, I mean. You know, that can get ugly at times. But generally speaking, I think as an organization, our heart's in the right place. And if liberals before I had a chance, you know, this is before my time. I've never had a problem with the CIA, and which is why I'd have no problem working for them. But I don't know. I mean, I came to this country in 1980. So I don't, you know, a lot of this more historical hostility towards the CIA by the left is before my time. So I may be missing nuances or something that. But from a modern perspective, you know, obviously things are a little different.
You've written about some of the interest groups and single interest groups on the left and how they have a sort of myopic perspective. And there's one instance where the National Abortion Rights Action League, you criticize them for endorsing Lincoln Chafee, who was a pro-choice Republican. Tell us a little bit about how you critique those sort of single interest groups and.
Yeah, I wish it was just narrow, but also now National Organization of Women, Sierra Club, the League of Conservation Voters. There's this, you know, on the left, on, you know, are the kind of the more progressive issue groups, environmental, labor, women's groups, gay rights, and so on. There's this kind of notion that you can negotiate with the right, that you can they. And once upon a time, you actually could. I mean, like I said, Richard Nixon, you know, created the EPA, created OSHA. There was a time when the Republican Party was a party that was actually interested in what was best for the country. And if that meant creating an environmental protection agency, then so be it. You know, we like to rag on Ronald Reagan. You know, his first year in office, he passed the biggest tax cut in the nation's history. Second year in office, the largest tax increase in the nation's history, because he realized, or you know, his administration realized, yeah, that wasn't working. You know, our nation now, our finances are completely in shambles. We got to do something about it. There was a Republican Party that was really interested in looking at reality and adjusting its behavior accordingly. That's an old Republican Party. This one really is completely beholden to one thing and one thing only, and that's its ideology. Nothing else matters. So if ideology says that Iraq is a cakewalk and they're going to, you know, shower us with flower petals and it's going to be easy and blah, 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 blah. It doesn't matter how bad things get there. You always have Dick Cheney talking about how we're about to turn a corner or those are dead enders that are attacking us and the insurgency is in its last throes. You know, you hear this all the time, mission accomplished and so on. Finances, taxes, tax cuts shrink the budget deficit, and if it keeps ballooning, it's because we need more tax cuts. There's no desire or willingness to really look at reality. Global warming is another one. You know, you can look at evolution. I mean, you can go down the list. They're not interested in reality. They're only interested in their ideology, and the fact that they have this very well-developed conservative machine, media machine, noise machine, you know, the Fox News and so on, makes it easier for them to live in that bubble, to pretend that reality doesn't exist, to create their own reality. Liberals are always kind of, you know, we work within reality. You know, that's what it means to be progressive, is to understand that you have to evolve with the times because the times change. While conservatives like to create their own ideology, create their own reality, and obviously it's very, very dangerous stuff. So traditionally you had these groups that, and they had a lot of success in the 60s and 70s and even in the 80s in impacting our national policy by working with Republicans. It was something that was done, and it was something that, you know, quite frankly, couldn't have been faulted at the time, and we had great gains in the environment and women's rights and labor in that era. So the strategy was good for that era. Now, when we have a conservative ideology that's supreme, they're not interested in compromise. They're not interested in negotiation or discussions. They're interested in one thing, and that's the destruction of everything that we hold dear. And this is very clear. They don't want to win anymore. I mean, look at how angry they are, even though they're the majority. They have the trifecta. They have the Supreme Court, the White House, and the Congress. And why are they so angry? Because we still exist. The fact that we exist pisses them off. They want to destroy us. And we have to realize that in that kind of environment, there is one party that will stand up for what we believe in and one party that will seek to destroy what we believe in. Now, those parties are both Big Ten parties. We have to have Big Ten parties because there's a lot of us with a lot of ideas, just two parties. So you have people in the Republican Party that are not horrid on the environment or gay rights or choice and so on. And there are people in the Democratic Party that are not good on those issues. But what matters at the end of the day is the leadership of the party in charge. Who's in charge of the House? Who's in charge of the Senate? In Pennsylvania, we have Bob Casey, who's going to win that race in Pennsylvania. He's anti-choice. He's an anti-abortion Democrat. He's good on everything else. But on that one issue, he's horrible. If he's in charge, I mean, if he wins and he helps us win back the Senate, we will have a party in charge that is dedicated to protecting choice. Bob Casey's vote on the issue won't matter because choice will never come up for a vote. I mean, this is the stuff that's important, is to realize that there's a bigger picture. We're not going to get perfect Democrats up and down, you know, because we're all individuals. We all think for ourselves. And as a society, as we have more and more access to information, a lot more of us are going to stray from the party orthodoxy on this issue or that issue because we're not going to sit and let a leader tell us how to believe, what to think anymore. We're going to go look it up ourselves, and we're going to disagree on times, whether it's on free trade, whether it's on choice, whether it's a lot of things. There are things that people will disagree on. And so we have to be cognizant of that, and we have to be tolerant of that, realizing that at the end of the day there's a party that's going to protect those things that we care about in the aggregate. There's a party that's out to destroy what we believe in an aggregate. So you see that with the issue groups on the right. They don't endorse Democrats. They don't. The NRA does not endorse Democrats at the national level. They'll endorse them at the state level where they can't do, you know, as much harm, but they will not endorse them at the national level. Yet our groups continue to think that, oh, well, if we reach out and if we endorse somebody like Lincoln Chafee, we can create bipartisan consensus, bipartisan support for our positions. And in an ideal world, that would be the case. But in today's world, that is not the case because Lincoln Chafee is a pariah in his own party, and he can agree with us on all those things. But at the end of the day, he, one, will vote for Bill Frist or his successor to run the Senate. Two, he has, because of party loyalties or other issues, has voted for every single one of George Bush's judges, every single one, except Alito. And in Alito, he voted for cloture, which was the only vote that mattered at the time. So he has enabled these radical right judges that are going to be affecting our national discourse for the next 30 to 50 years. He is not a friend of progressive causes, yet NARAL and the Sierra Club and League of Conservation Voters still pretend, they still live in this fiction that we can negotiate and compromise. It's a different world, and I'd love for the rational right to take back their you know, the Republican Party. It would make it, I think, in a lot of ways harder for us to beat them, but in a lot of ways I think it would be better for the country. But until that happens, these progressive groups that endorse Republicans or they work against Democrats are actually hurting their own causes themselves. I don't do short answers, do I?
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio broadcast, and our guest today is Marcos Melitzis, who's founder of the Daily Coast blog. You mentioned, you'd read a lot about consultants and how they are basically have both parties captive by what they do. So explain how they corrupt the process, and can any political candidate these days get outside the grasp of consultants and be successful.
Yeah, no, consultants are you know, there are good consultants. But D.C., inside D.C., it's basically run by a cabal of consultants. Like I said earlier, the party is the consultants. And there's about 8 polling firms, 8 media firms, about 4 direct mail firms that basically control all the business in the city, and they're not very good. And here's what happens is, one, their incentive isn't – their primary allegiance isn't to the candidate, because the candidates come and go, but the party's always going to be there. So they're always playing to the party. They're always playing to their own little circle of friends because they want jobs next cycle. So campaigns come and go. Who cares? The candidate doesn't like what we have to say. We don't care. We're not loyal to the candidates. A lot of these firms have 10, 15 candidates at any one time, so they can't even really dedicate the kind of attention that should be paid to a lot of these races. Two, there's a inability, unwillingness to adapt. You know, the Republicans are very good. I mean, it's you know, we had a Republican tell us that, I don't know why you guys keep hiring your consultants. I mean, if one of ours loses a race, we send them out back and shoot them. You guys keep hiring them. And you have somebody like Bob Schrum, who's obviously the poster child of Democratic consultant ineptitude. He was the a media consultant for John Kerry and 7 other presidential candidates, all who lost. Yet Kerry hiring him was a big hire of the season, right? He was like, he won the consultant primary because he got Bob Schrum, the guy who lost 7 previous presidential races. Now, you know what's funny about Bob Schrum is that he actually worked for a week with Jimmy Carter in 1976, and he quit that campaign in disgust because Jimmy Carter couldn't win. And so I still can't, I used to say, you know, had Bob Schrum stuck around, he actually would have been in a winning presidential campaign. But actually, I think in reality, had Bob Schrum stuck around, he would have sunk Jimmy Carter. He would have lost that one, too. So it's probably a good thing for Jimmy Carter that that Bob Schrum took off. So that's the environment that we live in. And they're very risk-averse. They don't want to take any chances. It's one of those situations where, I used to hear back in old days, old corporate America, where people used to say, well, nobody ever got fired for buying IBM. And it's that kind of environment. You don't want the kind of the young whippersnappers who are going to do things a little differently, because if they win, it'll be because they did things differently. I saw this in, very firsthand. After Howard Dean lost the primaries, I had 8 calls from reporters the next day after New Hampshire, basically saying, this proves that the internet is doesn't work for politics, right? And, it's funny, that's the lesson that the Democratic consultants took. Internet doesn't work for politics, right? The Republicans did not. They thought, holy crap, that was incredible. How do we use this for ourselves? And they work in it. It's just like saying, well, John Kerry ran television ads and then he lost. So television ads obviously don't work for politics. But that's the environment. These consultants don't want to learn anything new. They sure as heck don't want to let anybody in that might know how to do this, because that would be infringing on their turf. And since they control the flow of business, candidates don't have a choice. I mean, here's a perfect example. Like I said, no short answers for me. Missouri, 2004. Actually, start Missouri, 2000. Nancy Farmer ran for statewide office, won state treasurer in 2000, partly on the platform of universal health care. That was on her platform. She ran using state-based consultants, and she won. She won handily. It was a pretty good campaign. 2004, she ran for the U.S. Senate. And the SEC, which runs the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, runs Senate races for the Democratic Party, has millions of dollars. And they basically say, if you take our millions of dollars, you need to take our staff. Because, of course, they're handing out the contracts to their buddies and their friends, right? So they came in and they swept out all of Nancy, every single last one of Nancy Farmer's Missouri-based consultants, the people who actually know what it's like to run in Missouri, know the state, know how to message to people in the state, know the geography, know the tactics that work, swept them all out. Then they told her, you can't talk about universal health care because that kills us at the polls. This is somebody who had won on the issue, but she was muzzled. She wasn't allowed to talk about that. And she lost by 10 points. 12 points. She lost handily. It wasn't even close. And you'd think that the consultants that she worked with, you know, would be taken out back and shot because they basically muzzled somebody who was successful at winning statewide and had her lose handily. But no, they're still working. You know, they worked again in 2004 and 2006 are working. So this is the situation. This is the consultants we have now. One of the things that Republicans do that I find absolutely fascinating is that anybody who works a hot race, a very... You know, very much a contested race, a top-tier race, usually very young. It's like the hungriest, most, you know, they're the least cynical, most hungry, most ideologically pure, most driven, most innovative consultants they have in their party. That's who runs their newest campaigns. Ken Mellman runs the Republican Party. He's like 38. They used to say, you know, we had a guy named Simon Rosenberg running for the DNC chairmanship alongside with Dean. And he was 38, and they kept saying, well, yeah, he's too young. He's too young. He doesn't know about politics, right? The RNC is run by a guy who's 38 years old. He ran the Bush campaign at 36. You know, they had their youngest, hungriest people. And they know they're more in tune with the local, with the media environments, with the political environments as they change. Then what happens, after they run a few races, they get a little older, then they move them off to work the incumbents. So it's safe races. They don't need to be creative anymore. They're going to win handily. They can make a lot of money. So they take care of the consultants. But once you get to a certain age, it's kind of like, okay, yeah, you're too old to really understand what hardball politics today is really. So we're going to put somebody who's young and knows what MySpace is, knows what a blog is, right? Knows what the internet is. And that's the difference. And did I answer the question?
I don't think so.
I think
so. Yeah.
I'm trying to remember what the question was, actually.
Let's try some brief answers to some personality questions, and then we're going to go to questions from the audience. So if you'd like to move to the microphones, now's the time to start to do that. So three or so people interested in a quick take on them. How well is Nancy Pelosi doing in leading the Democratic opposition?
I'm not a fan. I have to say, but she's getting better. My problem with somebody like Nancy Pelosi is, and a lot of Democrats, you said short answers, huh?
Yeah, short and sweet, is or
they
short.
They're not realizing that the world has changed. She still thinks that the way to get a message out is to hold a press conference. Right? Nobody cares about press conferences. Reporters don't care about press conferences. It never gets to the end users. You got to go around the traditional media nowadays, and you can't. And we're building the media institution to do so. But also in the way she messages, it's always Democrats try to speak here. They think that if you pull out an Excel spreadsheet with a really complicated equation and people figure it out, then they'll go, oh yeah, I guess I should be a Democrat. When really Republicans hit people here, right, the gut, and that's where people make their decisions. And but she made a quote the other day. I know you're trying to push me, but she had a quote the other day that gave me hope, right? She said, they asked her about gasoline prices, and she said, you elect two oil men to the White House. What did you think was going to happen? And that's it. That's, you know, we don't need the charts and the graphs and OPEC and this and that. Hit right here, and that statement hit it. So I think they're learning. So I got hopes that things are getting better.
Is Al Gore learning? Will he run? Should he run?
He's not going to run. You know, Al Gore, he's having fun right now. Why would he run? You know, somebody once told me he'd be great because he knows what it's like to run for office. And I said, what it's like to run for president. And I said, that's exactly why he's never going to run for president. He knows what it's like. And he wants to talk about one thing. He's got one huge passion in his life, and that's global warming. And right now he has the biggest platform. Everybody's listening. The movie's fantastic. The PowerPoint is fantastic, if you can say that about a PowerPoint. And why would he throw that away to have to talk about Social Security lockboxes and Iraq, right? He wants to talk about global warming.
Hillary.
How many people here support Hillary for president?
Small handful of hands up in the audience.
Yeah, you know, I was on this 40-plus city book tour, and every... where I went, somebody in the audience would ask that question, what do we do about Hillary? It wasn't, how do we help get elected? I love her. It was, what do we do about Hillary? And every time somebody asked that, the whole audience would clap. And so I was kind of like, I don't think she has a lot of support nationally. You know, it's really telling that she has universal name recognition. Everybody knows who she is. Yet in the polls, that include basically a lot of no-names Democrats for 2008, she tops out at about 36 to 38%. I don't see her getting any more than that because they know who she is. And in fact, what's going to happen is what happened to Lieberman in 2002, 2003, is that as people realize that there are alternatives and that some of those are actually pretty darn good, I think she's going to bleed support. So her one chance in the primary would be to have a fragmented field, one woman against eight white guys. Pretty good chances, but I think the field will consolidate a lot sooner than that. And I'm not even convinced that she's going to run, so we'll see how that shapes up. And I don't think she's going to run precisely because of that. I think she really fails the electability question. People don't think she's electable, and that's going to be key, just like it was in 2004. People are going to ask themselves who is electable, and they don't see Hillary as electable, fairly or unfairly. I think it's fair, yeah.
Good. Thank you. Let's go to the audience question. Sir.
My name's Peter Gisella, and when I was in the Air Force back in 1973, I experienced the Yom Kippur War and the oil embargo afterwards, and it occurred to me that we needed an energy conservation corps, the equivalent of the Marine Corps, to help move this country to independence. And then in 1979, a moderate Republican congressman, Pete McCloskey, proposed a national service program that included universal registration for 17 to 18-year-olds to challenge them to consider volunteering for community service or military service. So since 1980, I've been asking both members of the Democratic Party, which I am, and the Republican Party to support a vigorous debate on this. And the best thing I get from them is silence. And I was a Kerry delegate at the Democratic Convention, and I've encountered more members of the Congress in the last 4 years since 9/11, and basically no silence. I got more letters from the Bush White House than I have from my Democratic Party.
So
what's the question?
The question is, what I would like to do, I have a MySpace site, so I know a little bit about that, and I have photographs.
How many friends you got?
2,200.
Okay.
I would like to set it up so that I have the list of every candidate that's running for Congress, whatever party they're in, and encourage people across the country to challenge them to look at my site, to look at this idea of a national service program, look at participatory democracy. You talked about the Democratic Party not having core values, and I think that this would be...
I think we have them. We just don't know how to communicate them. We don't know how to get it. We don't have the machinery to market it. No, I believe in national service, obviously. I always say that the best decision I ever made was to join the Army. The second best decision I ever made was to get out of the Army. So I wouldn't be who I am today without my military service. And one of the things that really pisses me off about the war is that it's now basically cut off as a vehicle for socioeconomic advancement for so many people like me who came out of places where we couldn't afford college. We weren't independently. We didn't have the money. We didn't have the beats. I didn't have the confidence. And all of that actually was given to me because of the Army. So I wouldn't trade my service for anything. Now a lot of people don't have that as an option because, of course, you don't want to get shipped off to Iraq. But, no, absolutely. I mean, I have 2-year national service after high school. I think a lot of us would be better shaped going to college, after 2 years. I think 17, 18 is a little young to go to college. Being away from family at that age is still kind of... I remember me when I was in Germany at that age. No drinking age. College would have been a disaster had I gone to college. I agree. But you know what? That would call for sacrifice, and we don't do sacrifice in this country. We send other people to die. We send other people to do the hard work. We don't do it for ourselves. And that's where the illegal immigration stuff really fails, too. Nobody really wants to do all the shit work that that the immigrants are doing, working in slaughterhouses and things like that. So that's stuff for other people to do.
Next question.
Hi, Marcos. My name is Alexis Bucknam, and I'm actually an alum of AmeriCorps, so I really believe in the whole notion of national service. But my question is more specifically about something that's been coming up here in the state of California more lately, which is the notion of clean elections and publicly funded elections. And I wanted to get some perspective from you on whether or not you support that, and then more importantly, what that does to the democratic process.
I'm still really undecided on the issue. I'm not convinced either way, to be honest. In a lot of ways, I consider publicly funded elections welfare for consultants. And right now, what theoretically would hopefully move the party and its candidates to use their money more wisely than these consultants that are pissing it away is the fact that they have to raise it, and that it's hard to raise that money. And if you're going to raise the money, you're going to want it spent well. If you get a big check from the state, then those incentives, I think, are even less. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I have a problem with my tax dollars going to pay for somebody's attack ad, nasty, sleazy attack ad. So my vision, you know, long term, is as the web evolves and people become more confident and more comfortable contributing online, you know, I think candidates will be able to do what Howard Dean did last time, which is raise a significant amount of money and not be beholden to any interest. To me, that's actually more exciting, more ideal. Forces candidates to connect to people, to build a movement. Right now, the candidates will brag about, oh, I got the NARAL endorsement and I got the, you know, this group endorsement and that group endorsement. What I want to see 10 years from now, this is kind of my long-term vision, is I want a candidate to say, I got 10,000 people who donated $25 to my campaign. That, to me, would be exciting. And that would be significant of something much broader. Because when people provide that $25, they're making an emotional investment in that campaign, and they're going to do whatever they can to make that campaign pan out and work. So traditional fundraising, this is where I'm kind of undecided or kind of on the fence, is because right now the system does preclude a lot of people, good people, from running for office. But we're not quite at the point yet where, you know, 10,000 people giving $25 is a viable option for most candidates. Some candidates will be able to do that, but it's still hard to really build that kind of network for most candidates. So we're kind of in this netherworld in between phase where my ideal isn't quite really viable. So I don't know, but that's where I'm at on the issue.
Seems like as long as that's the case, the people, the entrenched, wealthy, detached people you spoke about at the beginning are going to stay in control so long as, and they'll always have more money than your 10,000 friends with $10.
Yeah. Now, keep in mind that 10,000 friends with $25 donations, it's a motivated, vested army that'll do a lot more to help that candidate win than more detached supporters. So I mean, long term, and it may not be 10 years. I mean, it may happen a lot sooner. We're seeing it with a lot of candidates. There's a candidate up in Seattle area, Darcy Berner, who just via the local bloggers raised $90,000 the 48 hours before the reporting period. This is local bloggers. This is not a national race. This is a national excitement. It was just the locals. And a good campaign this early in the cycle can take that $90,000 and turn that into $500,000-$600,000 easy. So I think it's going to happen sooner rather than later. It's just making that happen at a broader level. I mean, you know, certain candidates are going to do it. Maybe 5% of the candidates this cycle may be able to work in that kind of environment. Over time, as people learn, you know, to get money online and get more comfortable doing it, I think that will grow. But in the meantime, I think we're kind of stuck in this limbo.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our guest today is Marcos Melitzis, founder of the Daily Coast political blog. Next question.
Hi, my name is David Jay with the League of Pissed Off Voters. My question is about...
Is that Billy's organization?
Yeah, that's Billy's organization. My question is about the community organizing side behind all of this. If we want to institute a broad change in the Democratic Party, if I want to do that, where do I go, who do I talk to, and will I have fun?
Will you have fun? Actually, no, not now. But one of the things I advocate for is the elimination of Robert's Rules of Order from all political meetings. Just kill it. Stab it. You know, stab it a couple times because the stupid thing won't die sometimes. And realize that politics, right now, it's so bureaucratized. It's just not even funny. I mean, these stupid conventions where they sit there and yammer on and arguing over stupid platforms, you know, like county party platform. Nobody gives a darn about their stupid county party platform. It means nothing. Yet they'll spend hours or days working, you know, as a comma here, a comma there. Are we outraged about the war in Iraq? Or are we merely concerned? Or, you know, let's find the right word. And it's not fun. It's so not fun. Furthermore, it's hard to find out how to take over your local parties. They purposely make that difficult because they don't want competition. They don't want people showing up, taking their jobs, because even if they do nothing, there's a certain amount of I don't know if prestige is the word, but they get something out of saying, well, I'm the county chairman of the Democratic Party. And if people showed up, they might actually force them to, you know, work, do something, be effective. But it's happening. It's happening all over the country. It's going to happen next weekend in Texas where people are going to take over the Texas Democratic Party. It's happened in North Carolina. It happened in Colorado. It's happening in Kentucky right now. People are taking over the local parties and going all the way up to the top. And so I can't tell you where to look for that information. That's part of the homework, I guess. It's fine. I mean, if there's a local DFA chapter, they may actually know. A lot of these takeovers of the state parties are being led by DFA chapters, Democracy for America. And so they may have done the research already. And literally, some of these county parties, I mean, showing up is all it takes to take them over. You know, show up with 20, 30 people, boom, you have a party. And once you have the party, you got to do something with it, right? But take it over, get rid of Robert's Rules of Order. One of the things that, you know, and I got to check in to see if she's done this. I was talking to a county chairman in Arizona. She loved the idea, so I hope she did. But I told her, get rid of Robert's Rules of Order. Start having your meetings at picnics, at parks, so people can bring their kids. And it's not just somebody sitting on a podium, you know, with a frickin' hammer, you know, calling people to order. But it's a conversation. It's a social event. Because then people are going to want to go because it's like a blog, right? You establish connections with other people. You make friends. And it doesn't become like, oh, crap, is it the second Tuesday of the month? You know, I got to go down to dingy, damp, smelly union basement, you know, union hall basement to hear some guy drone on and on about Robert's Rules of Order. That needs to change. That culture needs to change. And we need to go more to stuff like Drink It Liberally is doing and DFA and the meetups are doing is to become a social event. Because you know what the Republicans do, the conservatives? Churches. The social event. They go to churches. Yeah, you know, the God stuff. But it's a social event for them. It's they see their friends and their, you know, and other family. And while they're there, they also mobilize on you know, for their causes. So we need to become more like churches where the social element of it is as important as the political side of it.
Next question.
Hi, thank you. My name is Nicole Dersey. I work with a group called Power PACs, Increasing Voter Turnout Across the State. My question is, I appreciate what you're saying about the Dean campaign and the DFAs and what they've done, and I think they've definitely done something in terms of energizing folks, but it's still a predominantly white, middle-class group of people. And so my question to you is, how can both the Democratic Party and then just political organizing in general really reach out to reflect the population of this country, which is, you know, predominantly working class and people of color increasingly? So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. Thanks.
Yeah, that's where in large part, in my little perfect world, that's where the unions come in. I mean, that's why SEIU is so incredible an organization, because that's all their growth is coming in from Latinos and African Americans and a lot of immigrants too. This isn't just technology. I mean, there's different components. And when you look at, you know, this kind of stuff I'm doing, I mean, it's just a little piece of the puzzle. So that's important. I don't think blue-collar people will ever be on Daily Coast. They're working for a living. I don't blame them, right? They got more important things to worry about. They're working at the DMV or, you know, they're not going to be sitting on Daily Coast. The people who are on Daily Coast are people who actually can, like, is my boss around? Kind of turn the monitor. You know, have their worksheet up front and have, you know, kind of like the browser open so they can switch back to the worksheet if the boss walks by. How many of you do that? Yeah, okay.
Almost everybody.
And so that's not going to be your typical blue-collar worker. They're not going to be there. Now, what we can get, though, are a lot of community leaders and organizers that are talking to these groups, that are, you know, on the blogs, that are learning, you know, they're getting educated and, you know, talking points and action alerts and things like that. So it's important. But also, realizing that there's other ways to use technology to reach these communities. The highest penetration of cell phones in this country is in the African-American community. The second highest is in the Latino community, right? During the immigration rallies a couple months ago, we're heavily, heavily organized using SMS messaging and MySpace, the younger crowd using MySpace. They're out there using certain technologies. And some people go, oh, but they're not on the blogs. And they're not going to be on the blogs unless they're a certain, you know, educated office worker, you know, maybe on the blogs. But there's other places, and that's not a bad thing. I mean, people think that blog readers are young, right? It's a really big misconception. Actually, the average age of a blog reader at Daily Coast is about 45 years old. Doesn't mean young people aren't online. They're on MySpace. They're talking politics on MySpace. You know, there's different places that culturally fit their style better. So I think, you know, savvy people, you know, savvy campaigns and people who want to reach different demographics can't sit there and go, well, I wish the blogs were more represented. It's just never going to be. They're going to have to realize that it's just a slice and that they're going to have to talk to other people, whether it's using cell phone technologies to talk to these people or it's whether going through community organizations or labor unions or whatever else, realizing that it's a different ways to reach different communities. And like I said, I'm not going to reach everybody ever.
Next question.
Hi there. My name's Dawn. I'm going to shift my question a little bit based on your last answer, but I found there to be a lot of irony in your comments earlier about the state of the Democratic Party and what's wrong with it when they run campaigns, the fact that they're unable to adapt, they're conservative, they're risk-averse, in contrast to the Republicans, who are obviously hiring some young guns, they're very brazen, they're willing to take risk. I think that's part of the story. I think the other issue is that the Republicans have just been masterful at playing the mainstream media, particularly the television media, where most Americans still get their news. They're fantastic at character assassination and just plain lying. And I don't think those are necessarily tactics to emulate, but they have to be countered. And I'm wondering what your strategy would be if you were advising the Democratic candidate in 08, what do you do to counter those tactics, and you know, how do you really reach people with the message?
I'd be happy to emulate those tactics. I'm not above getting in the mud. They can do this because they have the vast right-wing conspiracy. They have the ability, they have the think tanks, the training institutes to develop their ideas, train their leaders on how to wield those ideas. Everybody in the conservative movement goes through a course on the history of the conservative movement. So they have an ideological foundation, philosophical foundation for what they believe in. So they all share that one source, that one origin of what they believe in. You know, obviously we don't have anything even remotely like it, so we all think differently about why we're progressives, why we're liberals. Nobody can agree. They have the ability to take those ideas and package them into a marketable format. They have the message machinery to deliver that to every segment of their base and use a megaphone, essentially, to amplify it to the point where it actually bleeds into the traditional media. And then they have the consultants and the party establishment that's modernized, and they can close the deal. So they create the ideas, they market them to the American people, and then they close the sale on election day. We don't have any of that. So in 2008, we're going to be at a huge disadvantage. And in 2012, we're going to be at a huge disadvantage. And I think it's going to be about 2016 where we'll have the ability to fight back effectively. Right now, they set the agenda. All we can do is respond. And we can push back as, you know, as much as we can. Now, what I would advise 2008 is to realize that people, you know, sites like Daily Coast now are read by the traditional media, and so if there's an attack, they need to come, you know, they need to be forceful, they need to come out and rebut it immediately, and they need to go around the traditional media because they're not going to get the access they want. The stupid press release, right, or a press conference, nobody reads that shit anymore. Nobody looks at those things. Nobody attends. What you're going to do is you're going to go, what are the blogs saying? Right, and if they see the arguments are flayed out, you know, and of course, campaigns, you know, they'll have staff, they'll have research staff of maybe 2 dozen people, a presidential campaign. I think Kerry had about 24 researchers. There's hundreds of thousands of people online that are going to dig around, and they're going to find stuff. And may have worked at one place where I remember this happened and that happened. And a perfect example was the debates. When Cheney and Edwards were debating, and Cheney said, I've never seen you before. I'm the president of the Senate. I haven't seen you before. And before the debate was over, on Daily Coast, we had two videos of them seeing each other. And about an hour after the debate was over, we had Cheney's schedule where he had actually gone to the Senate once in 4 years. So, and the press report that, and it killed that. In the old world, maybe they would have been harping on that. Oh, you know, Cheney's incredible debate performance. You know, he totally got Edwards because he hadn't seen Edwards. And, you know, it was dead. We killed it. Now, it's harder for us to start an attack. But at least we can, you know, we have some effectiveness in killing attacks. And as the blogs become more powerful and as Air America spreads, as local liberal talk radio spreads, I mean, those are so important. I mean, as I was places like Tallahassee, and I'm in the car and I'm going to the radio and it's all conservative. And I'm thinking, man, we can take over this local party. We can have better candidates. And they don't stand a chance because it's like the media around them is completely dominated by conservative voices. So we need to start building that local liberal talk radio. This is, like I said, this is all a long-term process. So I think by 2016 we'll be there. For now, essentially my advice would be to work with what we have. You know, we're this big, we're growing, but we're not going to reach parity with the right for another, you know, decade. But we got to work towards that. And that's something that people have to be involved with and help out with, even if they have the financial resources, help build the institutions of the vast left-wing conspiracy to counter what they have on the right.
Next question.
Hi, Marcos. Rains, longtime Cossack, less frequent overtime lurker. As, the site's gotten me more active. Thank you for that. I'm actually preparing to see you at Yearly Coast next week.
Very cool.
And excited about the energy around Energize America. And I wonder, will that be the Democratic energy platform? It seems like it has all the pieces.
I have no idea if it will be. I mean, I don't think we have much of an energy platform right now. So I don't doubt that smart people will be looking at it. Staffers, people like that will be looking at it. And so elements of it may be plagiarized, hopefully. I think long-term, I mean, to me it's exciting. I mean, for those who don't know, Energize America, a bunch of Daily Coast readers who are proficient in energy issues because they work in the industry or, you know, otherwise have a lot of knowledge of it, got together, and they literally put together over, about a year, put together a whole comprehensive solution to America's problems. And I don't have the ability to really, I don't know enough about the issue to look at it and go, yeah, that's the solution, right? It's brilliant. But I think a lot of people who do have that knowledge are going to be looking at it and deciding. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that, not just on Daily Coast, but just online in general. I mean, there's definitely a lot of excitement and ideas and stuff being put together that the party and elected officials are looking at. This is not a wish. I hope they look at it. I know they're looking at stuff on the site. And they're paying attention. So I hope so. I hope it becomes part of, at least parts of it get pulled in.
Next question.
Hey, Marcos. My name is Abendigo. I work at SustainLane.com, and we're all about making sustainability mainstream. And I'm just curious what you think about sustainability as a political issue.
Give me a broader... Sustainability could be the one of things.
We're more about like putting sustainability, making practical decisions in your everyday life, to, more sustainable decisions. Say eating organic, buying your food locally, things like that. We're not really looking at like abstract concepts so much as just putting it into your everyday life. And I was just curious. We're looking at kind of reaching out to the right, and we're in the Wall Street Journal. We're in these different media, we're covered in these different media outlets.
Right.
I'm just curious what you think about the term sustainability and how you see it as a political issue.
I don't know how much of a winner it is as a political issue at this point. I mean, I think clearly that's where we're all headed. I mean, that's the direction. I think the problem right now is cost. I mean, you look at organic foods, farmer market foods. I mean, a lot of them are more expensive than the crap you get at Safeway. From Chile or wherever it comes from, right? And if you want to build a sustainable home, it's going to be a lot more expensive to use sustainable materials, locally grown woods, and obviously solar power is more expensive. And so a lot of the components of living sustainable are still a little out of the reach of the average American and expensive, and I don't think you could really mandate those because of that reason. As a philosophy, it's fantastic. And a lot of people who have the disposable income can do things like slap on solar panels, not because it'll pay off in 37 years, but because, they feel better about themselves. But I think that's a big problem. Go ahead.
Well, Walmart just introduced over 400 organic products to all, 2,000 of their shelves. Like Pepsi is developing organic Pepsi right now. There's going to be organic frosted mini wheats. It's going to be crazy. In the next few months, any mom will be walking down an aisle and see this stuff. So it's... I don't know.
No,
I'm just curious what you think about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's a future. But like anything else that's kind of cutting edge, I think the barrier to entry right now is kind of high. And as more and more people do it and more farmers do sustainable practices, and you're going to see that. And more people buy sustainable products. I think, obviously, market forces come into play and make it a lot more affordable. I don't know if that's really a political issue, to be honest. I don't think anybody's against it. I don't think anybody hates recycling. Nobody that would say so publicly. Am I wrong? Somebody like, and so it's more. This is more of a lifestyle change than a political ballot box issue. I could be wrong, but and where it does become political is when the FDA tries to weaken the organic standards, and you know that's where it becomes political. And those efforts have failed so far, and I think as more and more people kind of jump on this bandwagon, it's going to get tougher and tougher for those efforts. But again, it's just like, you know, efforts to regulate the internet, just one of those things you just kind of keep an eye on. But the internet is growing because of a lack of government involvement, and we just need the government in a lot of ways to kind of protect what we have and not allow the telecommunication companies to impose roadblocks on the internet or things like that, right? So, but it's not a ballot box issue that I can really sense right now.
Let's finish up with a discussion about blogging and journalism. As blogging has become so popular, there's been lots of discussion about its role vis-a-vis traditional journalism. Just recently, a California judge ruled that Apple Computer could not force several bloggers to reveal sources that revealed confidential company information. I believe so that extends to online bloggers and reporters the same protections afforded to, quote, traditional journalists. I believe you wrote an amicus brief.
Well, I didn't write it, but I joined.
Joined in that. So why did you do that, and what's at stake, and where's the line between bloggers and traditional journalists?
Yeah, that line is blurring on a daily basis. Blogging, at the end of the day, there's so much fixation on blogging that I think in a lot of ways is counterproductive. Blogging is a tool, first of all, just a tool. It's like a word processor or a video camera, how that tool is used. People are doing journalism on blogs. People are doing muckraking, yellow, you know, rumor mongering on blogs. People are doing their just, you know, Dear Diary on blogs. So blog can be used for anything. Beyond blogs, then you have the MySpace stuff. You have the social networking sites. You have wikis. You have podcasting and video casting. And you have instant message and email lists and Google groups and Yahoo groups. And so you have the ways to communicate online are so vast, and there's so many of them that it's really, you know, we got to get away from just blogging to understanding that the internet's much bigger communication tools. And I don't know if there's a word for it yet to encompass everything. In the political realm, we talk about netroots, which kind of encompass all of those things in their political applications.
Are there cues that people can tell when I'm reading a journalism site that's playing by the traditional rules of journalism versus blog, which is, you know, lower standards or no standards of fact-checking or attribution, that sort of thing?
You know, bloggers, it's, you know, one of the beauties of this is that it forces people to actually think, you know, have to assess for themselves how reputable something is. I have one thing going for me when I blog in my writing is my credibility, and I'm not gonna surrender my credibility to something that's unsourced or whatever. And people over time see that I'm not gonna jump on, you know, BS type stories. Therefore, I have more credibility than most, and I'm, you know, my tolerance, the bar for me to jump on a story is pretty high. Let others kind of probe and see if there's anything there, and if there's something there, I'd be happy to poster their efforts. And that way I protect the credibility of the site. I turn the site into something that's more credible. There are sites out there that are not. I mean, right now, Truthout is under attack because Jason Leopold, one of its writers, wrote that Karl Rove had already been indicted and this was coming down. And I didn't touch a story with a 10-foot pole because I knew the writer had no credibility, and I knew the story, if it turned out to be true, would it turn out to be true by accident or by coincidence rather than by actually he knew what he was talking about, because I know he's not. And his credibility's toast. Truthout suffers. Daily Kos isn't, because I didn't jump on the story. So that's what we got. That's what we have online. Now, we can talk about journalism standards of ethics all we want, but we all know that journalism is, you know, there are no journalism. There may be ethics on the books, but nobody follows them. I mean, the profession is a cesspool right now of conflicts of interest and ideological biases that is, in a lot of ways, destroying what it stands for. I think this pretension that they're, you know, fair and balanced, not the Fox News way, but the one where they actually believe it, is under attack from a lot of different quarters. I mean, right now we've been trashing a AP reporter, John Solomon, because he's been reporting, he's on a crusade against Harry Reid, our Senate Minority Leader from Nevada. And his stuff hasn't held up to any scrutiny. I mean, it's all fallen apart to the point where now latest reports are that the AP starting to look into it and think about doing something about it. But in the past, nobody would have pushed back. It would have kind of sat out there, and that would have been the end of it. And now people are watching what they're doing, and it makes it a lot harder for them to peddle their stuff as fair and balanced when a lot of times it clearly is not. So I don't have a lot of respect, I think, for a lot of traditional media in that sense. Now, a lot of the misreporting that's going on, a lot of the problems are kind of the problems that a lot of big corporations are facing, where these reporters are overworked from years of layoffs after layoffs after layoffs. The newsrooms are decimated. People who once upon a time had, you know, to write two stories a week, and they had a time to actually source stuff and research it, fact check it, now are forced to write a piece a day or a piece every 2 days, and they don't have the time. So they're essentially writing warmed over press releases, or they'll accept the right wing spin on something just because they just don't have time. And the right wing is so much better organized that there's always somebody they can call. On our side, they don't have that place you can call to find sources or get information. So it's easier for the right to get their sources to these overworked reporters. So there's a lot of problems. But I'm not going to sit there and think there's this golden age of media where the media is sacrosanct and all these bloggers are just making a mockery of everything that these, you know, hardworking journalists stand for. In a lot of ways, there's great journalism happening in the traditional media, and there's a lot of great journalism happening on the blog world. And there's a lot of crap happening on both as well. I mean, it's the media. It's just another medium. The blogosphere is another medium, and it's just like the regular media. There's the good, the bad, and the ugly.
We've reached the point of one last question, so we'll have a quick 1-2. Do you have conservative friends, people that you hang out with? And
no.
What? I knew I'd get a short answer eventually out of this, but I tried hard enough.
Actually, I had a couple, but they've kind of flipped, so.
Did you flip them?
I don't think I did. One of them worked for Enron. So Ken Lay flipped them.
What conservative thinker or politician do you most respect?
Chuck Hagel in Nebraska, senator.
Because he's running, I mean, because of his stance on the war?
No. He's always been consistent on everything, and he's always been, I mean, talk about straight shooter. McCain wishes he was a straight shooter like Chuck Hagel. And when I praise Hagel, people seem to take it as an kind of like secretly liberal Republican. And he's not. And the guy's got like an American Conservative Union rating of like 98%. So, but I respect him. You know, I'll disagree with him on a lot of things, but I actually respect him because he's unafraid to stand for what he believes in. I don't think he's that beholden to political pressures, or at least doesn't show it. So, yeah, I respect the guy.
Please
I wouldn't vote for him. That doesn't mean I'd vote for him.
Please give your thanks to Marcos Melitzis.
Thanks.
And his thanks for us. Thank you, Marcos, for coming to the Commonwealth Club. I'm Greg Dalton, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is closed.